At least we got one thing going for us.
The one constant through all the years, Ray, has been baseball. This field, this game, it's a part of our past, Ray. It reminds us of all that once was good, and it could be again.
Hey, America's pastime is suddenly a global export. The World Baseball Classic has grabbed the attention of players and nations around the world. Forget the Yankees, here come the Dominicans. Can baseball save the world? Why not? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Baseball, save the world. Good morning. It's Thursday, March 5th. I'm John Hockenberry. Farai Chidea is in for Adora Udoji, who's spending time with her new baby. Good morning, Farai.
Hi, John. Coming up this hour, the next fight over gay marriage opens in a California court today. The legal battle pits Ken Starr against a transgender lawyer. You don't need a law degree to figure out who's arguing what side. Plus, if, like us, you're totally obsessed with the movie of the Watchmen graphic novel, you want to keep listening later this hour. If you're not obsessed, trust us. We'll have a conversation worth your time. All this and more ahead, but first, the headlines.
Topic A at the White House, health care. There's an afternoon summit planned that will bring together lawmakers from both parties, doctors, patient advocates, and industry leaders. Who won't be there? Hillary Clinton. Remember, she's Secretary of State. A new report coming out later this hour may introduce us to hundreds of thousands of Americans newly worried about losing insurance. The latest jobless numbers are out in less than half an hour. Economists believe more than 600,000 new people have filed for unemployment benefits.
Wow. The site of today's gay marriage battle we just mentioned is the California Supreme Court. Lawyers are going to debate Proposition 8, the ballot initiative that outlawed gay marriage. That brings the issue full circle. That same court legalized same-sex marriage in 2008. Today is the beginning of the latest round. Judges have 90 days to rule after hearing arguments on today's case. And across the country, in Washington, the House is set to vote today on a housing bill aimed at helping some homeowners avoid foreclosure. It would give people who meet certain conditions access to new mortgage terms. The bill was tweaked a bit after loan companies complained it was too harsh on them. If it passes, it still needs to clear the Senate.
Overseas Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in Brussels for her first meeting with NATO foreign ministers. Afghanistan is a lead topic there. The White House is sending 17,000 more American troops and wants NATO allies to do more. The meeting will also cover Russia. NATO cut its ceremonial ties with Russia after it invaded Georgia. Several NATO countries are ready to reestablish that relationship, however. So the Dow and S&P both gained yesterday, rising more than 2%. Ends a five-day streak of losses for the Dow, but futures suggest the losses will continue when trading opens on Wall Street this morning. The S&P begins trading at 712. In a moment, we're going to take the details of the Obama housing plan and look at them with Alvin Hall. And we're specifically talking about housing all morning. We want to hear specifically from homeowners. Are you discovering you can't afford your mortgage payments anymore? If you are discovering that, first of all, we commiserate with you and we want to hear from you. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. What do you need the government to do to help you? Let us know. Tell us the story at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I'm Farai Chidea, sitting in for Adora Udoji. Good morning.
Good morning, everyone. For homeowners all across America trembling a bit behind their financial stockade, you might say that Obama brought out the cavalry yesterday.
If we act boldly and swiftly to arrest this downward spiral, then every American will benefit.
Every American? Well, that would mean you, Pamela Zombeck.
Yes.
And who do you reach out to find out if you can get connected to this plan that was unveiled yesterday?
We've been working with a legal service out of California who's been negotiating on our behalf. So they've gathered all the accurate paperwork and have submitted things to our banks.
Quickly, you are in Salem, Massachusetts, right?
Correct.
And this is your home, correct?
Yes, it is.
And how long have you lived there?
2 years, 2.5 years.
And, you know, a lot of the names that have been used for homeowners over the last year or so during this crisis as it's deepened, you know, speculators, people trying to flip homes. Are you one of those folks?
We don't. No, we're a single. This is our primary residence. We don't own any other property.
All right, hold on, Pamela Zombeck, because I'm going to introduce you to Alvin Hall, who, of course, is our dear friend, takeaway contributor, financial advisor. He's right here in the studio. Alvin, you know, Pamela Zombeck is not every American, but she certainly is an American, a homeowner
yes.
who Obama presumably was trying to reach. But the homeowner crisis, the housing crisis, the property crisis in America is sort of twofold. It involves homeowners who need security.
Exactly.
But it also involves the price of this asset called land and property in America, the demand for which needs to increase for prices to stabilize and Americans broadly to feel more secure. Let's tackle the first one first. Homeowners. Did Barack Obama help a broad swath of people who are worried about insecurity yesterday?
For those people who live in their homes, it is their primary residence. This does offer some hope, provided their property isn't deep underwater. So if you live in your house and your mortgage is qualified for Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, and you have the income to support that house, then you can refinance. That's really important. You must have the income to be able to support that mortgage to be able to refinance. So there's a little formula they put into place. If the value of your home, take the value of your home, multiply it times 105%. If your loan is less than that, equal to or less than that, then you're eligible for refinancing. So, Pamela, you here?
Yes, I am.
Yes. What is the amount of your loan at the moment?
The amount of our loan is $286,000.
$286,000. So, mm-hmm. I think, what is the value of your property? Give me an estimate at the moment.
Well, that's not, we're thinking it's around $300,000 to $325,000. Zillow has things much lower, but from what we see in our area, we think that we're in a $300,000, $325,000.
Pamela, what's Zillow?
Zillow is an online appraisal. It takes into account a lot of different factors, and they tend to be way under market, but some people use them as a reference to what your home is worth.
Thanks, okay. Pamela.
So if we take Zillow, let's start out with the worst-case scenario, and they say your house is worth $270,000. You multiply that times 105, you come out with a number of $283,000. So
okay.
That means that you don't qualify under Zillow's estimate by $3,000.
Ouch.
It's quite amazing. However, if we use your loan number, which is $300,000, and multiply that times 105%, we come out with $315,000. With a $286,000 mortgage, you do qualify. So
okay.
Everything with you will depend very much upon whether or not the evaluation of your house comes out correctly. And then you'll be able to lock in a fixed-rate mortgage, which is exactly what you need. Because your mortgage rate right now is about how much?
9.5% and 11%.
Oh, wow. My God. Oh, yes. I think we're all grabbing for our nitroglycerin pills here.
Yeah, Pamela, this is Farai Chidea, and those are practically credit card rates. I mean, how did you get into a loan that gave you such unfavorable rates compared to so many other homeowners?
Started out at 7.44%, and that was the lender, they wouldn't give us anything but 100% financing. We had decent credit, we didn't have perfect credit, and we had money to put down. They wouldn't accept those terms.
They wouldn't accept your money down?
No.
This is so strange.
Well, but this is an indication of the unusual circumstances, the unusual terms that over the last 2 years have characterized all kinds of homeowner financing arrangements. Pamela, we're going to step back for a moment. Stay with us.
Sure.
Alvin, you know, there's the other side to this.
Yes.
And that is if the only people who bought and sold houses in America were people who are in their primary residences— I mean, I'm no economist, but I think it's the case that prices and values for homes and property in America would crash through the floor. The demand for property is, in some sense, a result of speculators, of people who have three and four homes or who buy homes in large tracts, correct?
I agree with you. But historically, the price rise of homes kept pace with the increase in income. So 7, 8% a year was pretty normal, 5 sometimes. But what happened in the last couple of years, people bought into this idea that they could actually buy multiple properties and then live off of the income from those properties solely. In the past, people might have done that, but they would put down payments on each of the properties that they bought, or they would wait until they built up enough leverage in the original property and use that. But today, as soon as it went up a little over 20%, people were pulling money out of it and using it to buy
right.
new properties.
Well, that's not Pamela's situation
no.
here. And finally, you know, we've got a few minutes here, but I want to just get the sort of basic survey
yes.
out of the way. I mean, on some level, this is a write-off for thousands of Americans who don't have an income, who are underwater on their properties and are defaulted on their mortgages. This bill, this program from the Obama administration basically says, we got nothing for you.
We got absolutely nothing because they don't have the income to support the properties. They've already gotten so far down the road to foreclosure, they're just wiping it out. So literally, they're going back to being renters. Even if you live in a house that is underwater and you do not meet the 105% requirement, you cannot refinance your property. You cannot.
So
therefore, you virtually become a renter in a house that you're living in.
So the community's full of abandoned homes in places like Las Vegas, in suburban California, in Detroit, in
yep.
Cleveland that
yep.
we discussed mm-hmm. yesterday. Nothing for
nothing,
them.
Nothing at all. Yeah, it's a sad situation because I think that the previous administration let this problem run on too long. So now we're running in after the properties have been abandoned. How do you bring those people back? How do you rebuild those properties? You literally can't. You can't rewrite history at this point. I also think, one last point, that the administration is tend to focus on this in a more traditional way. They view primary home ownership as a way of saving. So that's the way it was thought of for years. But now people think of owning a second home as a way of speculating in the market, right? They are saying if you speculate in the market, then you, unlike Lehman Brothers or any of these other organizations, AIG, you as an individual, you're not too big to fail.
Oh, that's interesting.
Alvin, this is a quick one because,
yes.
You know, I don't want to get you too far off track. Mm-hmm. Any last word about what we can look for first-time home buyers?
I think first-time home buyers, if they save diligently and get a great down payment together, they will be able to pick up some great properties. But what they don't need to do is to rush in and feel they have to do it now. You should look around and remember those old rules about location, location, location. Buy the best property you can and no longer feel the need to buy that McMansion so that you are overextended.
All right. Well, Pamela, then is it conceivable? Can you see on the horizon the possibility that if you can hold and stay in your home for the next couple of years, that prices may stabilize and that your community, financially speaking, will improve?
Oh, absolutely.
And
I'm an optimist with all this. I truly am.
Now, what's going to make the difference for you? Is it getting a new job? Is it other people in the community going back to work? Is it people not defaulting in the streets next to yours?
I think the employment is a huge factor right now. I'm a meeting and event planner, so me working anytime soon is probably not realistic. But I think that anyone that I talk with that's unemployed, and I know a lot of unemployed people right now, it's the job situation. I think once the jobs that gets under control, having people not leave their homes, I mean, it's everything kind of will balance out.
Well, she's an optimistic leading indicator. Pamela Zombeck, if you start getting calls to plan some events, let us know, because it means things are starting to turn around up there in Salem, Mass. Pamela Zombeck is a homeowner in Massachusetts, struggling like millions of Americans to figure out if the federal government is going to help them. We want to hear from you. Also, Alvin Hall, takeaway contributor here in our studio. Thanks, Alvin. And tell us your stories if you're having difficulty making your mortgage payment, specifically 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. What can the government do specifically for you?
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Farai Chidea, sitting in for Adora Udoji. Hollywood tries to give us enough multi-million dollar blockbusters to sell all that overpriced popcorn and candy. But what happens when a big-time movie comes from a book that already has a following that may or may not like what they see? John and I are, well, I would say fanboys, but I'm a girl. Let's call me a fan lady. And I love graphic novels like Alan Moore's The Watchmen. It's set in an alternate 1985 where the U.S. is a hair away from nuclear war with the Soviet Union, launches with the murder of a superhero, veers into questions of how to save the world.
Congress is pushing through some new bill that's going to outlaw masks. Our days are numbered. Till then, it's like you always say, we're society's only protection.
From what?
You kidding me? From themselves.
So we want to ask folks, does this movie really matter to you, or is it just another Hollywood blockbuster? John, what do you think?
Oh, man, I'm so excited about Watchmen. But, of course, I'm kind of a freak. I mean, everybody isn't into this. I mean, there's still people on the street who I say
you're,
Watchmen.
You're holding the comic no book. Yeah. Make some flipping noises.
I'm looking at Rorschach. And, you know, I'll tell you, the quality of this movie doesn't even matter to me. For me, it's kind of like walking into my own daydream that I've been having about Watchmen ever since I bought the book back in the 80s.
All right. Well, with us, we've got Elizabeth Rapp. She writes the blog GeekBeat for Cinematical.com. And like us, she has to wait to see the film. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you guys?
Great. So really, for someone who does not care about this at all, and I mean everything Watchmen, somebody who's sick of seeing smiley faces, doesn't know what people on the subway or, you know, in the bookstores are reading, just give me a couple lines why folks should care.
Well, I think people should care about this one because if you actually hate the comic book movie, if you just can't stand The Dark Knight and Iron Man and some of that, you might actually like this one because it takes apart so many, if you know it comes through right in the movie, the book took apart a lot of the myths that surrounded superheroes and made them very realistic people who had problems and issues and things like that. And so if you go and see it, you might actually enjoy it because it's kind of deconstructs the image of a, you know, happy-go-lucky superhero and also has a lot of political and social relevance to today, even though it's set in a 1985, an alternate 1985. It reflects a post 9/11 world in a really creepy way.
Yeah, it's full of conspiracy theories and conspiracies, and you know, one of the things that's interesting to me, which I think bears on the relevance of Watchmen, Elizabeth, is that you know most comic book characters came directly out of the Depression, where Americans used comic books as a kind of a salve for a whole variety of social ills that they maybe wanted to escape from. The characters in Watchmen are really straight out of the 1980s, are very much post-Depression. They're not like Iron Man or Batman at all.
Oh, exactly. And it's kind of funny because one of the biggest problems with that I've had trying to explain Watchmen to people is, you know, you give them the book and they're like, well, I don't get what was so shocking about it in the 80s. And it's like, well, because this wasn't done yet. You know, superheroes were nice people. And, yeah, Alan Moore comes along and has them breaking people's fingers and, you know, having weird sexual issues and things like that. It's a very 80s thing and yet a very modern thing that people, I don't think people realize how much of sort of the flawed heroes came from what Alan Moore did in that book.
But, so you're saying we live in an era of broken fingers and weird sexual issues? Is that what you're saying?
Well, like, you know, Jack Bauer breaks somebody's finger, like, every week on 24. It's like not a big deal anymore.
Yeah,
Rorschach did it in the book, it was just like, oh, my God, you just, the heroes just don't do that kind of thing.
Yeah, it strikes me that shows like Lost and Heroes probably learned a lot from this. But I want to get to something that you talk about in the article you wrote, which is gender. There are plenty of women who collect comic books, read graphic novels, but there's not always a lot of give and take on what a woman looks like or acts like within the pages of comics and graphic novels. How does this this graphic novel, Watchmen, work with or against those stereotypes?
Well, Watchmen is a really problematic one because at the time, I think that it's sort of sending up the very sexual image of superhero girls like Wonder Woman, and I'm trying to think which ones were out about that he's kind of making fun of. Wonder Woman is probably off the top of my head, though. It's kind of problematic because the female characters are very sexualized and very shallow. Like I talked about in my piece, Lori is like maybe one of the least feminist characters you might actually see. I mean, she's very dependent on men. She's very defined by her relationships to the men in the comic. And yet I think she's kind of remarkable and different than other superhero characters that you might see, because she actually does have a story arc and she has very human problems. It's the stuff you might see in, like, you know, any chick flick, but it's kind of unusual because you see it in this superhero context of, you know, she has mom issues and dad issues and issues with her boyfriend who just happens to be blue and glowing.
Right, happens, yeah, the blue and glowing, that's great. And that's Billy Crudup is going to be playing that character, right?
Yeah. He will be Dr. Manhattan.
So before we go, though, who's your favorite, Rorschach?
Yeah, actually, it's the comedian. I like the comedian. It used to be Night Owl, but once I read the book a couple more times, I jumped ship.
Well, we're not going to tell people what happens to the comedian, but Elizabeth Rapp, thanks for your time. And Elizabeth Rapp writes the blog GeekBeat for Cinematical.com.
We're hearing from some homeowners this morning.
Our mortgage has become a real burden for us. It wasn't always so before my husband lost his job. Anywho, what I believe the government should do for us is help us communicate with the banks to get help lowering our mortgage so it would be proportionate with our household income.
Tell us your stories. What can the government do for you if you're having trouble making your mortgage payments? 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. Personal headlines from you. Now, the headlines from Femi Oke.
Thank you very much. 29 minutes past the hour. President Obama not dealing with mortgages today, but he has called a White House meeting to get some ideas on how to fix our health system. About 120 doctors, patients, business owners, and insurers with a wide range of views have been invited. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in Brussels to meet with NATO foreign ministers today. She's expected to discuss the Obama administration's new strategy in Afghanistan. NATO will also consider its formal ties with Russia. And a top executive from the Swiss bank UBS says the bank had made mistakes in helping American clients evade income tax, but the bank still refuses to share more information on their U.S. clients about their secret accounts. Let's look at stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry for iJadea, as in for Adora Udoji. Good morning, Farai.
How you doing?
In a moment, we're going to find out what's behind some pretty large demonstrations out in California as courtrooms fill up today on some pretty interesting legal issues. But first, we're talking about housing all today. We want to hear what you're dealing with. What does home ownership mean to you today? What questions do you still have about whether you qualify? And does anything under the Obama housing rescue package help you? We want your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Fry?
Well, folks, in November, California voters went to the polls and outlawed gay marriage. Now, 18,000 couples wonder if their marriages are legal.
Say we're worried about all the marriages. Of course we are worried about ours. It's we waited 20 years to be able to get married officially, formally, where we've been married since September 5th. I'm more worried about what this means for the future for all gay and lesbian people.
Now, the state Supreme Court, which hears arguments today from the advocates who say the ballot initiative never should have been on the ballot in the first place, and those who say the voices of the voters need to be heard. Kenji Yoshino is professor of law at New York University. He's also the author of the book covering the hidden assault on our civil rights. Now, Kenji, this seems like deja vu all over again. Wasn't it the Supreme Court of California that legalized gay marriage last year?
Yes, indeed. In May of 2008, the California Supreme Court handed down a landmark decision saying that it violated the equal protection rights of gay individuals in order to prevent us from getting married.
Okay. What's the significance for people who are nowhere near California?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, it's a practical matter. This does not affect marriages outside of California. This is being done under the California Constitution, and therefore doesn't affect anything outside of California. So it's not going to go to the United States Supreme Court. The United States Supreme Court could not hear this case, even if it wanted to. As a sociological matter, I think this has had ripple effects across the country. So I think people are outraged, and the gay community is outraged over what has happened in California. So I think that we'll see a lot of discussions, a lot of activism around marriage because of this decision and because of Proposition 8.
You know, when I was covering Proposition 8, there was so much rancor between gay rights advocates and some members of the black community because there was a lot of black people did this because black people voted in large numbers for Proposition 8. So did some other demographics, you know, specifically religious demographics. Do we have any sense of how people are lining up by demographics around this issue, around this case?
Well, I really hesitate for I to point fingers on this issue because one of the things that we know about gay marriage is that some version of the Bradley effect obtained, so that what people say to pollsters is really different from what they do in the voting booth. So ironically, with respect to President Obama, we didn't see at the level of the election the Bradley effect. We saw it at the level of the New Hampshire primary, but we didn't see it at the level of the election. Ironically, November 5th in California, we did seem to see the Bradley effect with respect to gay marriage.
Hmm. This is a landmark case, but it's also a bizarre forum in a sense. I mean, you've got Jerry Brown in there representing the state of California. You've got Ken Starr, who's basically an ideologue representing groups that supported Prop 8. And then you've got Shannon Minter, a transgender attorney, arguing for the National Center for Lesbian Rights. What's it going to be like in that courtroom?
Well, it's going to be a really exciting oral argument, and I really encourage people to tune into it. You can tune into it at www.calchannel.com. It's going to be from 9 a.m. to noon in Pacific Standard Time. So people can tune in at any time during the day. As you said, John is going to be in Jumbotron as well, so people can watch it on the big screen if they want to. So what is going to happen here is that Shannon Minter is going to argue that this should have been done as a revision to the California Constitution as opposed to being a simple ballot initiative. And Ken Starr is going to argue the opposite. And the person to watch is going to be Chief Justice George in the center, who is a key guy. He both sits at the center of the court physically, but he sits at the center of the court ideologically as well. So his questions and Joyce Kennard's questions are going to be the questions to listen to most carefully.
And this is a constitutional issue. It really doesn't so much involve the kind of emotional center of whether gays should be allowed to be married or not. It's a constitutional question of whether the people can speak through the ballot measure or should the constitutional revision process, which is another formal process in California, be the way that these things are defined?
That's primarily right. There is a constitutional rights issue that has been argued and will be argued today as well, which is to say, can you take away this fundamental right from a minority group? But, John, you're essentially right that the large point here is whether or not you can do this as an amendment, which only requires 50% of the people of California to vote, as they did on November, as they did in November, or whether this requires a revision. Really, in order to put that in layman's terms, the difference is between a change to the Constitution and an overhaul. And if you want to overhaul the Constitution, then you actually need a two-thirds vote of the legislature or some more radical change.
All right, Kenji, just quickly want to play you a little bit from a married couple about civil unions versus marriages.
You know, we've been together now 20 years, but when we set the date to get married, people from Jeannie's family in New York flew out to California. The Italian Catholics came. You know, people don't fly cross-country for a domestic partnership certificate, but they do for a marriage. And I got cards from her 80-year-old uncle who said, "Welcome to the family." That's a big deal. That's how we recognize family.
In closing, do you think that marriage is significantly different from civil unions, which is what President Obama seems to support, civil unions?
Absolutely. I think marriage is categorically different in its symbolic effect and in its material effects. But even if you just leveled out the material effects, the symbolism is completely different. One way to ask that question is to ask the people who are saying, why is this so important to you, to gay people, to ask back to them, well, why is it so important to you? Why is it so important to you to withhold this from us?
All right. That was Kenji Yoshino, professor of law at New York University and author of the book Covering the Hidden Assault on Our Civil Rights. And now we've got headlines with Femi Oke.
Good morning. 21 minutes to the top of the hour is the time. We have some new figures in from the Labor Department this morning. New unemployment claims dropped to 639,000 and the continuing claims have also fallen. Automaker Ford wants to exchange up to 40% of its debt for cash and stock. The goal is to wipe out more than $10 billion in debt, and Ford's hope that it will actually put it in a better position to compete with GM and Chrysler, both of which took some federal government bailout money. Ford says it still does not intend to seek federal aid. The EPA will hear arguments today on whether states should be allowed to regulate greenhouse gases from auto exhaust. The agency could reverse a decision from the Bush administration that keeps states from setting their own vehicle emission standards. And the former First Lady Barbara Bush is said to be resting comfortably after undergoing heart surgery last night. And the surgery replaced a valve, and the operation was scheduled last week after Barbara Bush complained about being short of breath. As a look at stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. So they got a problem on Battlestar Galactica. They've got to find a planet called Earth. But NASA's Kepler mission has quite another problem. It's looking for Earth-like planets all around the galaxy, and it's set to launch March 6th, which is tomorrow at about 10:48 p.m. Eastern Time. And reporting on all things outside of the solar system for our program, The Takeaway, Miles O'Brien joins us, a CNN science correspondent. Miles, thanks for being with us.
Good morning, John. I just should point out I am inside the solar system this morning, however.
That's where I tend to stay as well. So, Miles, first of all, the Kepler mission, it's not looking for spectacular things that the telescope Hubble was aimed at, beautiful pictures. And that's not to say that there was anything frivolous about what Hubble did. It's got a more sophisticated problem to find Earth-like planets. How is it going to do it?
Yeah, it's not easy to find Earth-like planets because the places that we want to look for are very close to bright objects, also known as our sun. And so how do you find a planet of our size and our proximity to our sun orbiting another sun when it's so bright? The trick is this. You want to find the slight dimming of the light as the planet passes in front of the star. But that's not an easy problem, is it, when you consider the size of the sun and then the size of our Earth? The analogy that they've been using is this. Imagine a flea walking across a headlight, and you're a couple of miles away, and you're able to detect the change in brightness of that headlight. That's how sensitive this device is.
So they've done that with larger planetary-sized objects, say maybe Jupiter-sized, but they can only find things the size of Earth by leaving the atmosphere. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, there are about 300 planets that have been identified in the past 15 or 20 years with ground-based telescopes. And the way they do that is what's called the Doppler effect. They are essentially measuring the wiggle of the star. As the planet orbits around, it actually has enough gravitational pull to actually make the star wiggle. And that's how they've inferred that there are planets out there. They've never been able to do this so-called transit approach because from the ground, you can't make it out. And so this space-based telescope will be able to detect that slight dimming of a star as an Earth-like planet passes in front.
And according to William Borucki, who we spoke with earlier this morning, science principal investigator for the Kepler mission, it answers a very basic question humanity has always had.
People, you know, from all over tell me that, again, when they were kids, they would look at the nighttime sky and wonder what was out there. And they never lost that interest, that romance. And so they're still very interested in what's out there. And basically, this tells them what's out there. Are there lots of planets like Earth?
It's William Borucki who's crossing his fingers for the launch tomorrow. You're one of those kids, right, Miles?
Oh, you bet. You bet. And, you know, imagine what this all portends, John. It's very likely in the next few years they'll be able to identify some Earth-like planets. In other words, in the so-called Goldilocks region beside a star at the right place where liquid water could exist, a terrestrial planet. And then there'll probably be another mission that will focus on that planet, and we might one day get a picture of a pale blue dot
that's
not our own.
Well, that's what Kepler will start doing tomorrow. Miles O'Brien, the Takeaway's intergalactic correspondent. Thanks for joining us, Miles.
My pleasure, John.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Forget spring training. The World Baseball Classic is the latest late winter relief. More about that in a moment. First, headlines from Femi Okay.
Thanks, John. The time is just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. NATO foreign ministers are in Brussels for a one-day meeting. It's their first since President Obama took office and the first attended by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. She's expected to discuss Afghanistan with them. The US and NATO each have about 30,000 troops there at the moment. President Obama announced he will deploy an additional 17,000 in the next few months. Sudan's President Omar al-Bashir is defying an arrest order from the International Criminal Court. He calls the court's decision a conspiracy designed to recolonize his country. The Sudanese government also ordered at least 10 humanitarian organizations to leave the country. Vanessa Van Shaw is from Doctors Without Borders, and she's been told to leave.
You know, everything that we've been doing about plans to return to reopen Muhajiriya Hospital, start the vaccination campaign in Kelma Camp, and return to the clinics in the Jebel Marra is completely up in the air.
The United Nations have described the area around Darfur in Sudan as the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. And the African Union is holding an emergency meeting today to discuss the arrest warrant for Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir. President Obama is extending sanctions on Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe for another year. He says that people close to him continue to undermine the country's democratic process. The sanctions target people and companies linked to Robert Mugabe with travel bans and asset freezes. That's a look at stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi. And it's once again time to talk about stolen bases, home runs, and shutouts. The whole world is watching. The World Baseball Classic kicks off its first day of play this morning. Defending champion Japan crushed China 4-0. a real shutout, the first shutout, first play. America's pastime is taking the field around the world, though. The World Baseball Classic started in 2006, and, you know, maybe it wasn't exactly, you know, viewed as a tsunami of sports participation by the world. This is America's pastime, by the way. But it has become an electrifying late winter tradition that's probably going to preclude spring training at some point. Jorge Pinada is the editor-in-chief of Dominican Today. He's on the line from Santo Domingo in the Dominican Republic, where the Dominican team is expected to be a world favorite in the baseball classic. Alex Rodriguez may be playing for the Dominican team. Jorge, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
How huge is the World Baseball Classic for your readers?
Right now, the readership is, you know, forgetting about the economic problems which affects us as any part of the region, and they're just wanting to see the players take the field, you know, and try to make the best of it, because you said Alex Rodriguez was supposed to play, but the latest we have is that it's really up in the air right now.
And that's because of what?
He apparently had to go to check his some back problems in Colorado. And it's right now, there's no guarantee that he'll be able to play.
Well, he certainly has said that he wants to play. And I guess the question really for people in the World Baseball Classic is that you get to see players outside of their American team uniforms. They become national players. And what other players are we going to be seeing in the World Baseball Classic outside of, say, Yankee uniforms or Texas Ranger uniforms or Dodger uniforms?
Besides Alex, the Dominicans are really looking to David Ortiz and, of course, the leadership, a very, very well-chosen manager, Felipe Alou. The Dominican players are really eager to play with him because they have so much respect for him.
Is the style of play in the World Baseball Classic different from the major leagues in the United States or the leagues in Japan?
I wouldn't know about other countries, but here in the Dominican Republic, we pretty much see the game in the same way the Americans do. We enjoy it as our national pastime, too, but even more so because of such a tiny country, you know, we have so many players in the major leagues. It's really something that can only be described as a fever or just a madness.
Jorge, this is Farai Chidea. I just, you know, it's funny. I just saw at a film festival this film called Sugar about this guy, Sugar Asokar. It's a fictional film, let me say, but it's all about the field leagues, you know, and the minor leagues that are in the Dominican Republic that come to the U.S. Explain to us why the Dominican Republic, you know, is just this avenue for players entering the U.S.
Some I have actually heard this from physicians, that even the physique of the Dominican Dominican men is perfect for baseball. It's a height, let's say, of average 6 foot, weight around 170, 180 pounds. You get speed, you get enough power, and, of course, the pitching, sinewy bodies and the hot weather burns away fat. These kids, when they're 12, 13, they just start just creating the right muscles. And the areas around the southern coast, you have a lot of flatlands. And the Americans brought not only the military invasion back in 1916 and 1965, they also brought their sport, you know, the U.S. sport, and we took it, you know, just like our own.
So if you're Dominican, you've got a natural gift, but for everybody else, I guess the only option is to take steroids. How is the steroid controversy in the United States really affecting baseball fans in the Dominican Republic?
We're looking at it really in disbelief. But of course, most people don't understand what it's all about. What you know, to a Dominican in the street, what is a steroid? What is anabolic? What is testosterone? You know, what does it have to do with the sport? But unfortunately, here you have the problem with materials are used mainly for livestock and by veterinarians, and they're legal over the counter. So a lot of the, not only baseball, but a lot of other people in sports use them.
Well, let's talk baseball then for a second. What's it going to take to defeat Japan, do you think? And how is your paper sort of handicapping the potential for the Dominican team to go all the way?
It's amazing, but the Dominicans are really afraid of the Japanese team because last year's win to us was more like a fluke. We are definitely looking to Cuba because I think that's the team to beat this year, as was last year.
And is that because of offense or defense?
The Cubans have a pretty well-rounded team. They have always fielded a very tight, very disciplined team. And our problem seems to be just that we're good and talented, but last year, for example, it was bad management, and this year with Felipe Lu, we think we can beat everybody else.
Well, preventing the Dominican collapse this year, we'll see if the Dominicans are in there, also the Cubans. Today's game is already over in the World Baseball Classic. Japan, a shutout over China, 4-0. Jorge Pineda, the editor-in-chief of the Dominican, thanks so much for being with us. He was on the line from the Dominican Republic. We're talking about housing all day.
Anyone that I talk with that's unemployed, and I know a lot of unemployed people right now, it's the job situation. I think once the jobs that gets under control, having people not leave their homes, everything kind of will balance out.
Why'd you guys get rid of the Dominican music there? Come on, let's why? We don't need to go back to this. Come on. Crossfade.
Oh, come on.
There we go. Crossfade. No, they're not going to do it.
Come on, John.
That was Pamela Zombeck, struggling homeowner in Salem, Massachusetts, with very serious problems there.
It's really astounding. And, you know, I just have to give credit to so many people who are just, you know, bearing up under this. A lot of people have found some inner strength. And it's impressive.
And they're looking at the fine print, too, to see if anything from the federal government is going to help them. Pamela Zombeck actually talked with Takeaway financial contributor Alvin Hall today.
Nicole Jackson from Detroit, Michigan. I'm calling about a home where it was purchased for $150,000, and now the value of our house is somewhere around $30,000. What is the administration going to do?
Alvin Hall said that, you know, there's not much the administration can do with those kinds of collapses in housing prices. A lot of people with similar problems. More than 70% of underwater mortgages are in five states: California, Florida, Nevada, Michigan, and Arizona. We want to hear from some of you folks at 877-8-MY-TAKE. The administration plan does help with some of those underwater mortgages, and there's a website, financialstability.gov. Not much there yet. But stay tuned. Maybe the feds will actually produce some fine print that will help you. 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. We also talked about gay marriage in California. Does the vote of the voters need to be heard?
I wanted to point out that living in Massachusetts, where they recently legalized gay marriage, the entire Commonwealth has not spiraled into some kind of chaos. Nothing has changed for the rest of us who are heterosexual. California's got to get it straight.
Lessons from Massachusetts to California. That was just one of the things on the program.
I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. It's all there on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Good morning, Mr. Scott Mintz.
Good morning, Chuck.
Realtors and economists, I understand, have something of a bad word for you, don't they?
Well, what's that word?
Well, I mean, during the boom years in Southern California, you acquired not one or two houses, but how many?
I actually probably acquired, right now I have four. And I was fortunate enough to be able to get rid of a few before the crash.
Well, I mean, we wouldn't call you Donald Trump or anything, but some people say you're a speculator, right?
I don't find that being a bad word, but yes, I'd put myself in that category.
Does the Obama housing plan help you keep all of your houses, Scott?
I'm in transition. I don't know what's going to be happening yet with my houses.
How many do you think you'll be able to keep?
My main focus is to keep the one I'm living in. And sometimes it looks like I'd be much better off if they just take the rest away.
Well, 4 minus 3 equals, we'd call that hope, keeping it in the house on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Keep hope in the house. That's our slogan this morning. Good morning. It's Thursday, March 5th. I'm John Hockenberry for IJadea, as in for Adora Udoji, who's spending time with her new baby. Good morning, Farah.
Hi, John. Coming up this hour, the White House tackles health care reform. We know how this movie ended in the Clinton years. We'll see how the Obama team is going to try to write a new script. And later, you'll meet someone who wants change on Wall Street. Actually, he practically wants to demolish it. We'll explain how a total reboot of the economy would look. Those stories and more ahead. But first, these headlines.
639,000. That's the number of newly unemployed Americans. A new report just came out last hour on unemployment aid claims. It's no comfort to anyone on that list, but today's figure is a drop from the previous week. One of the worst parts of losing your job is the fear of losing health insurance with it, and health care will be the topic A at the White House today. An afternoon summit planned will bring together lawmakers from both parties, doctors, patient advocates, and some industry leaders.
Another worry for the unemployed is falling behind on home payments. The House is set to vote today on a housing bill aimed at helping homeowners avoid foreclosure. It would give people who meet certain conditions access to new mortgage terms. The bill was modified recently after loan companies complained it was too harsh on them. If it passes, it still needs to clear the Senate. And the gay marriage battle flares up again today. This time, California Supreme Court is in the arena. Lawyers will debate Proposition 8, the ballot initiative that outlawed gay marriage. This brings the issue full circle. The same court legalized same-sex marriage in 2008. Today's the beginning. Justices have 90 days to rule after arguments.
That's an interesting case. Overseas Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in Brussels for her first meeting with NATO foreign ministers. She meets tomorrow with Russia's foreign minister. The Dow and the S&P both gained yesterday, rising more than 2%. The S&P begins trading this morning, and it looks like a down day on Wall Street, at least at the beginning. The S&P begins at 712. Is there a home for speculators in the Obama $75 billion homeowners rescue package? We're talking about housing all morning. Are you discovering you can't afford your mortgage payments anymore? Do the math. If you're coming up short, call us at 877-8MYTAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. What do you need the government to do to help you? If they're going to help speculators or not, we'll find out in just a moment. But we want to hear from you on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry for IJadea, as in for Adora Udoji.
Hello.
So the big question, do you stay or do you go if you're a homeowner? That's really what people are looking at in the $75 billion homeowner rescue package that the White House rolled out yesterday. Alvin Hall, our Takeaway contributor and financial advisor, is here to help us explain what's going on. But we're also joined by Scott Mintz, who we spoke with at the top of the hour there. He's a real estate investor from Southern California. I called you a speculator, Scott, which I certainly didn't mean as a pejorative, but describe how you went from being just a chiropractor to something of a real estate mogul down there.
I always wanted to have a house, and it took me till my early 40s to purchase my first one. And it was definitely a fixer-upper, and I learned from that particular house how to take a rundown shack and bring it up into being pretty much a desirable property.
And the economy and banks, and really there was a lot of encouragement for people to do just exactly what you did, right, Scott?
Yes.
Now, you have four houses at least, and I don't want you to describe the details because I don't necessarily want to tell all of America about your predicament in such great detail, but one of your houses you're actually living in, correct?
Correct.
And is that the one that's the most valuable, or maybe the one that's the most valuable one? Okay, great. Alvin Hall is here, Takeaway contributor. And last hour we were talking about what the Obama housing bill would do for people who have a primary residence, and that's it. This hour, we're going to talk about what a person like you, Scott, who for a whole variety of reasons, perfectly viable economic reasons, went from being a homeowner with an income from, you know, another profession and actually spend a lot more of your time actually developing real estate properties. Scott, so here's Alvin. What's your question for Alvin, Scott?
Well, my situation, which I think a lot of people's in, is I own a house. I probably owe about $1 million on it, which is two loans, one being about $700,000 and one being a second for $300,000. Not able to make the full payments now. I've been working with the company to do a modification and got some relief for the first, which, you know, as far as it's a temporary relief, I see it as. And on the second, I'm looking at possibly my best option is to go bankrupt, and I've been told that the court may modify that or take that second away.
That's interesting. One of the reasons you're having problems modifying your second loan, because if it is your primary property, the maximum loan you can have is generally around $417,000 to be a conforming loan under Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac rules. However, California is one of the 59 designated high-income areas of America, so or high-value areas of America. So therefore, the amount of your conforming loan may be higher. So at $700,000, Scott, what do you think the value of your house is?
$650,000.
Ooh.
$650,000?
Oh, that hurts.
Yeah.
It hurts very much.
Yeah. So if we take the value of your house, I'm doing this right now since we're live and since I have my calculator with me, we take $650,000 and we multiply this times 105, we come out with an answer of $682,500, which means that you do not qualify for refinancing. So you will have to go after a modification of the loan. And that's a much more tedious, if you will, process. Because in this case, you have to show that you, the mortgage, in this case, you do qualify because the unpaid mortgage balance must be around $729,000, which you qualify for on the first mortgage. The loan originated before January 1st, 2009. That's certainly true. And do the mortgage payments eat up more than 31% of your gross monthly income?
Oh, yes.
Yes. So it seems as if you do qualify for a modification. Your big problem may be that second mortgage that you have, because the people who hold that second mortgage must agree either to subordinate that mortgage or at least write it down in some way. And that's what you're going to have to do. You're going to have a really hard road ahead of you, a long, hard road, but you might be able to hold on to your house.
Any suggestions on avenues as far as is it true that the bankruptcy court, the judge has that option, or is it actually that goes back to the modification side?
Well, you have to go through all of this process to prove that you're worthy of going bankrupt these days.
Wow.
Under the Obama administration's proposal, the bankruptcy judge then has the ability to alter your mortgage if they believe after the fact that you can hold on to that mortgage changing it.
So you got to qualify to be bankrupt,
yes,
and qualify to get a modification. Scott Mintz, good luck to you out there. We'll check in with you again, all right?
Thank you.
All right, Alvin, we got two questions from the audience. Let's take
yes.
the first one really quickly.
Hi, my name is Pat from New Jersey. I called my lender yesterday after the details of the plan were announced, and I tried to get the threshold question answered of whether my loan was held by Fannie Mae. I'm looking to refinance, and the first thing the person told me was we're not at liberty to disclose that information, and they made it incredibly difficult for me to get any information about how I could make use of the plan. So I think that there's going to be a lot of problems with getting lenders to be responsive to their customers.
Whoa. Alvin, what's the suggestion there?
He needs to go to the federal government's website, put in his information, and the government will tell him if his loan is actually owned by Fannie Mae.
Here was another Obama reaction and a question for Alvin.
Hey, good morning. My name is Lynn Aloff. I'm from New Jersey. I had to laugh this morning when people are talking about having mortgages started at 7 and went to 11. Back in the 80s, I bought a house. You could get a 17% mortgage. That's it, a three-year re-adjustable.
So we bought pretty small houses because we were paying 17% interest.
Is that what we have to look forward to, interest rates rising?
Well, interest rates will eventually rise because of inflation. But I think many of these people bought the house under the idea that you should buy the maximum house you can, the maximum you can afford, because real estate values are only going to go up. I think we're going to move back to the day where people look at what they can actually afford through good times and lean times when they buy houses.
But it means, and I guess this is the takeaway, and we'll say goodbye to you, Alvin, the takeaway is demand is going to be down.
For
a property, because the Scott Minces of the world are not going to be able to weigh in and do what they did, do the fixer-upper and the sell and the flip, and that's going to affect demand. Alvin Hall, thanks so much for being with us, as always. Takeaway contributor and financial analyst Alvin Hall in our studio. Fry?
Thanks much. One person who made headlines for a bold plan to reform health care is not taking part in it. We're talking about Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. As First Lady, she championed a health care policy that failed to become law, and Cheryl Gaist Stolberg, reporter for our partner, The New York Times, is joining us because she wrote an article about this. Is Secretary Clinton trying to distance herself from the bruising political firefight over health care during the Clinton years?
Well, I wouldn't say that. First of all, she's got a new job, a busy job as Secretary of State, but she does still stand as a symbol of the failed health care reform of the 1990s. And the Obama administration is trying to distance itself from that, and so she's really got no role in this at all. To some people, that's kind of sad. They see her as a tireless advocate for health reform, and now suddenly health reform has a chance of passing. It's been her dream for a long time, and she's out of the debate.
You describe her, you use the word baggage. What is the baggage that some political observers think she has?
Well, she's the symbol of that plan, and it really imploded on Capitol Hill 15 years ago. It was drafted in secret by a bunch of policy wonks. They delivered it to Congress as a fait accompli. It was bogged down with complaints that it would deprive Americans of their ability to pick the doctors that they wanted. There are all kinds of bad memories about that plan, and the name that's associated with the plan is Clinton, and Mrs. Clinton spearheaded the effort, so of course she carries baggage.
All right, so you have this White House summit on health care. She's not there. She's traveling. Also, senior Obama advisor David Axelrod said, "I think we've got her pretty well occupied." Now, you could just say, well, that's because she's traveling, but it also sounds a little patronizing.
Perhaps a teensy bit. Maybe it was just a turn of phrase. I don't know. She is pretty well occupied. The other thing is the Obama White House is really trying to put out the message that they've learned from the lessons of the Clinton plan. And this is a tough trick. They have to say, well, we've learned from the lessons of the Clinton plan, but we're not really relying on Mrs. Clinton for any help.
All right. What stands out about Obama's approach to health care? Tight.
Well, a couple of things stand out. First of all, just in terms of process, they're trying to bring lawmakers in early, go for wide bipartisan support. They're trying to do it out in the open. But also, he is talking about expanding health care beginning with children, and this was actually a big difference between him and Mrs. Clinton during the campaign. She wanted a mandate for coverage of all adults.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I don't know if we can get there. We need to open the door with kids first, and that's going to be probably a sticking point in this debate. How far is he willing to go?
Well, Cheryl, that's perfect. Thanks so much. That's Cheryl Gay Stolberg, White House correspondent for our partners, The New York Times.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Here's a question. Can the government help you stay in your home, or...
The question really should be, what should we do for our country in the first place? I think people are going to have to take responsibility for their decisions.
and allow the government to simply, well, get out of the way, stop making things a little bit more complicated.
What do you think? 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. If you can't afford your mortgage payments anymore, what do you need the government to do to help you or not? We want your stories.
And I'm Farai Chidea, sitting in for Adora. After 35 years, New York State's widely criticized Rockefeller drug laws are about to be reformed. The laws give mandatory minimum sentences that don't allow judges to take into account circumstances of the case. Journalist Jennifer Gonerman is author of the book Life on the Outside, The Prison Odyssey of Elaine Bartlett. Bartlett is a mother of four who spent 16 years behind bars for selling cocaine in New York. First offense. Now, these Rockefeller laws were passed in 1973. Since then, there have been attempts to reform them over and over. Jennifer, first of all, look, describe some of the criticism.
It's just what you said, the fact that they set up a system of mandatory minimum punishments, which meant, in effect, that judges really did not have power to decide how long somebody went to prison for. It didn't matter if somebody was a drug kingpin or a drug mule. Whatever amount of drugs they were caught with, that determined their punishment. It wasn't up to the judge, so the judge couldn't, you know, send somebody to treatment if they thought that was a better option. And now I think finally legislature is going to do something about that.
So there was a reform in 2004. What did that do?
It just lessened some of the most severe sentences, but it certainly didn't tackle the heart of the Rockefeller drug laws, which are these mandatory minimum drug sentences.
And where are we now in this debate? What looks like it's going to unfold?
Well, the Assembly has just passed a bill which begins to repeal some of the most onerous aspects of the drug laws, and it looks like this year there might actually be a serious reform bill passed by both sides.
What's the impulse on mandatory minimum sentences? Is it the legislature or the people in a state deciding that they want the job that the judge has, that they're essentially usurping the bench?
You know, these laws are the oldest of their type in the country. New York was first in 1973 when they set up the system of mandatory minimums. And I always thought it was really kind of a soundbite solution to an incredibly complex social problem. Back then, none of the experts thought it was a good idea. Actually, I was looking up some old quotes last night, and at the time, Mayor Lindsay himself said that this was merely a deceptive gesture offering nothing beyond momentary satisfaction and inevitable disillusionment. And now, 36 years later, I think that's exactly what the Assembly and Senate are starting to conclude.
And we should remind people the Rockefeller drug laws gave birth to the three strikes, you're out kind of federal impulses and some of the other, mandatory minimums that have grown nationwide, right?
Yeah, they essentially established a blueprint for fighting the so-called war on drugs that was copied by every corner of the country and have essentially been the engine that have driven the prison expansion in this country over the last 30 years.
Along those lines, there's been some recent revision of the crack cocaine laws on the federal level just for people in federal prison, pretty limited in scope. There's still so many jurisdictions that haven't really addressed this. Is there a national movement to reconsider what mandatory minimums and what America's drug policy is?
There's certainly a national movement going on, and in some ways New York is a little bit behind the times. A lot of other states have already tackled their mandatory minimums and started to dismantle them. I think what a lot of states are concluding is that we simply cannot afford to keep so many people locked up. We have now more than 2 million people behind bars, and states simply can't foot the bill anymore and have, I think, come to conclude that this extraordinarily expensive experiment in crime control simply has not worked.
But wouldn't it be equally stupid or short-sighted to just get rid of the Rockefeller drug laws without re-engaging a serious debate on alternatives to prison?
Yeah, I think what this bill that the Assembly passed really does begin to have that conversation in a much more meaningful way than we have had. And it's really about drug treatment and how does that work and how can we divert people into drug treatment and make sure they get quality treatment. I'm not exactly sure how the state plans to pay for all that in a time of fiscal crisis. But, you know, I think part of that conversation also has to be the fact that a lot of people get locked up under the drug laws are not addicts, don't need treatment, they really just need a job, you know, and so that's another part of, I hope that will be part of this conversation about what happens with these people if you're not going to lock them up for long periods of time. What are you going to give them to do?
Jennifer, one of the things that will stand out in my mind was that I went to a meeting in Oakland, a community meeting, and this woman said, I'm a mother, and I know that, you know, people of color are disproportionately locked up on these drug laws, but I don't care. I don't want my kids around crack dealers. I don't care. What do you say to someone like that?
I think that's fair enough, but I think if her kids got older, if one of them did get locked up and got some outrageously long sentence for a relatively minor crime, I think she maybe would have looked at the problem slightly differently. I mean, I think it's really the what hasn't really been conveyed in the coverage over the years. You know, people have been fighting these laws since the moment they were created. They fought them with statistics for many, many years. But the fact is that the true impact of them is incredibly difficult to convey in a short news story, in a newspaper. And the human cost of these laws has been extraordinary. The cost in human lives, to families, to entire neighborhoods, the lost years, the kids who grow up without any parents, the hours wasted in New York, at least taking 8-hour bus rides across the state to see loved ones on the weekends. You know, the gouging of poor families by phone companies for the incredible exorbitant rates for collect calls. Thousands of people are now walking around New York State with felony convictions, which are sort of like having an invisible scarlet letter, you know, making it very difficult for them to get a job, which can prohibit them from getting public housing or a student loan. And if you're still on parole here, at least, it means you can't vote. So, you know, the collateral damage of these laws has been extraordinary. I think it's something that states across the country are only really beginning to grapple with and calculate.
Well, thanks, Jennifer. Now a contributing writer at Mother Jones in New York Magazine, Jennifer Gonerman is the author of Life on the Outside, The Prison Odyssey of Elaine Bartlett, and has been following the discussion around the New York State Rockefeller drug laws for some time. Femi, okay with the news.
Thank you very much, Farai. Just coming up to 28 minutes past the hour, getting news in from the auditors for automaker General Motors. They are saying, I'm going to quote them here, that they are saying that there will be substantial doubt about whether the company will be able to continue their operations. GM says that they may need to file for bankruptcy protection if they can't work out a successful restructuring plan. And that news comes out of a report that GM is filing with the SEC today.
It's their annual report. That's substantial right. doubt they can yeah. continue as a concern. That is a huge story.
Major story. President Obama takes another step towards overhauling healthcare today with a White House summit. Lawmakers, doctors, drug executives, and patients will all be there. The president campaigned on a plan that would build on America's existing system to move toward universal coverage, and aides say that he's open to many other ideas. The former First Lady, Barbara Bush, is said to be resting comfortably after undergoing heart surgery last night. The surgery replaced a valve which came from a stock of animal parts. Surgeon Dr. Gerald Lowry performed the operation.
The surgery involves removing the valve. We take the aortic valves from pigs. This is a commercial process, and they're turned into off-the-shelf spare parts, essentially.
And Barbara Bush is expected to stay in hospital until next week. Let's look at big stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I'm Farai Chidea, sitting in for Adora Udoji. We are talking about housing all morning on the news that the government has launched a website to help us understand whether we can get help. We want to hear specifically from you, people struggling with mortgage payments. What do you need the government to do to help you? Questions? What do you know about what you need to qualify? We want your stories. We want to know what's going on in your life. Call 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. 877-8-MY-TAKE. John.
So all week long we've been talking about the border region between the United States in the Southwest and Mexico. And normally this is a region where immigration policy and immigration enforcement is the big issue. But that's not the case anymore, as a war between Mexican authorities and drug lords south of the border is creating the conditions of a war zone along the communities on the border. Think about Brownsville, Texas, right across the way from Matamoros in Mexico. All you have to do is ask someone like Elizabeth Garcia how things have changed.
there's now a more visible presence, military presence on the Mexican side. So people now, you know, we still going to the Mexican side, but now we think twice because we're afraid, you know, something's going to happen to us once we cross.
Elizabeth Garcia works and lives in Brownsville and Matamoros, like lots of families in this area. You could also ask Eddie Lucio.
I'm like fourth or fifth generation Brownsville native. You know, that same amount Texan. I grew up along the border, and there wasn't a great fear, you know. We went across the border. We ate in restaurants in Mexico. We went shopping, and, you know, at the little markets. It was part of our culture.
Those were the good old days, and Eddie Lucio is a Texas state representative from Brownsville. Things have really changed, and for families who need to cross the border every single day, they've changed dramatically. Joining us now is Carlos Cascos, who's a Cameron County judge. Brownsville is in Cameron County, Texas. And Ildefonso Ortiz is a crime reporter for the Brownsville Herald. They both join us from Brownsville. Carlos and Ildefonso, thanks for being part of the program.
Thank you, John. I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Ildefonso, how have things changed, and particularly for families who actually have to cross the border, whose economic livelihood depends on passing north and south every single day?
Well, the more dramatic change you can see is whenever they go into Mexico, at the bridge, the Mexican authorities will actually have army troops at the border. They will walk in, and once they pass customs, they're going to see military soldiers and armored vehicles at the bridge. So that's kind of a regular sight nowadays. Other than that, I mean, the cities are, it's just like a regular other city, except for the fact that you will see army trucks patrolling the cities. So people will actually be seeing army as a regular part of their day.
Carlos, we've heard stories that people, you know, take their flak jackets when they go to the south, and, you know, maybe that's hyperbole, I don't know. But are people feeling insecure in Brownsville about their neighbor to the south?
Well, I don't know if you can call it insecurity. I think what Mr. Ortiz said is very appropriate. You know, I mean, but, you know, the military has been along the border, at least in Matamoros, for years. So this is not anything new. I think what we're seeing is a more concentrated effort of a military presence. But in the past, there's always been a military there. I mean, I remember it from 8 to 10 years ago, but they weren't as dense as they are today. And the humor back then when we would go to Matamoros would be that yeah, there was a lot of soldiers and military guys, but they carried one bullet in their pocket. And today it's a different scenario. Today they're armed. They're heavily they got a lot of support in terms of infrastructure. As far as us going down and crossing and taking flak jackets, no, I don't know of that. I mean, I don't know if that occurring, but I think that there is a sense of cautiousness, especially those of us that do live on the border that are familiar with the border. We must be diligent. We must be careful when we go. And it's not so much that you as a tourist or a visitor are doing anything wrong or inappropriate or hanging around the wrong crowd. It's that, you know, you could actually end up in the middle of a battle between the military and some of the gangs and the drug cartels.
Well, there you go. I mean, that's terrifying enough. Ildefonso, I can imagine that in Brownsville, people might actually applaud the Mexican authorities' attempt to crack down on the cartels in the border region in places like Matamoros and Juarez over in the El Paso area. Is there any confidence among people in Brownsville that the Mexicans can actually pull this off?
Well, the average citizen is actually kind of happy that the military is in Mexico. There have been some protests from people with other ties that want them out, but overall, I think the people are confident that there will be an increase in violence as they start taking down the drug lords. However, the border area on this side, they've taken precautions. They've set up meetings between all the law enforcement agencies to keep the violence from spilling over into the U.S. side. But the people, they're confident. They're happy with the army, actually, in the area.
How has things changed for law enforcement organizations, Carlos? Certainly the story for us up in the north is that the drug lords have had something of a free hand in the border area. If that changes, how does it change, say, you know, your job?
Well, my job as a county administrator really doesn't change other than providing the support for our local law enforcement. You know, this has to, in order for all this to work, and I think the primary issue here is what people are concerned about on the U.S. side, is that there is a spillover. Right now, all of this violence and you know is focused and concentrated along the interior of you know, of Mexico and along the border, but more specifically around the El Paso, Ciudad Juarez area, Laredo, Nuevo Laredo. A couple of weeks ago, we had a shooting just up river from us, where several people were killed, and others were injured because there was a street battle, you know, between allegedly you know the military and the drug cartels. The problem is that as people that live along the border and the law enforcement will tell you a lot of times, you know, the bad guys are better armed, better equipped, and better financed than we are. And we're government, and if you know we cannot provide the type of weaponry that the drug cartels provide their bad guys. So you know somebody walks out with a shotgun, and these guys pull out AK-47s. And wow. I don't want anybody to misunderstand it. It's not like lawlessness on the U.S. side. I mean, everybody goes to work on a regular day, and everybody's fine. It's when you go into Mexico and along certain parts, not all parts. Some of that has not trickled completely down to us.
No, and I think you know you're making the point that it's all about where the bullets fly and the unpredictability of finding yourself in the wrong place at the wrong time, something that even that is new for people of Brownsville. Carlos Cascos, Cameron County Judge in Brownsville, and Ildefonso Ortiz, crime reporter for the Brownsville Herald. Thanks so much to both of you.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Even with the troubles in the auto industry, the admission this morning from General Motors was still pretty shocking. In its annual report, the company said, quote, our recurring losses from operations, stockholders' deficit, and inability to generate sufficient cash flow to meet our obligations and sustain our operations raise substantial doubt about our ability to continue as a going concern. The words substantial doubt and going concern are sort of financial speak for prepare to abandon ship. Our newest listeners in Detroit are getting this news. It broke within the last hour. Jerome Vaughn joins us. He's news program director for WDET in Detroit. Jerome, is this a strategic move on GM's part, or is this a kind of final admission that the end is near?
I think it's a little bit of both. You know, it's strategic, you know, it has to be open and honest about where things are. It has to prepare shareholders and the public for where it might go. The company says, though, that it doesn't expect necessarily to go to bankruptcy, but it needs to lay the groundwork in case that's where it goes. You know, the cars aren't selling the way that they thought they were going to be selling, and if that continues, it's going to be hard for them to, as they say, remain a going concern.
Jerome, hey, it's Farai. Just thinking about your city, where I was recently, it strikes me folks are so strong, but this has got to be something that takes a toll, the constant news. What do you think this announcement is going to do for people in Detroit psychologically?
I think, you know, there's going to be a good deal of concern about it, a good deal of worry about it. And, you know, but it's all imaginary right now in a lot of ways. I mean, nothing has happened yet to say, all right, GM is going to go to bankruptcy. So right now it is psychological. It's going to wear on us. I know, you know, already a few people I've talked to this morning, it's a concern. So we'll see where it goes.
The tangibility may occur in the tough negotiations GM has ahead with its bondholders, with the UAW, and in trying to gin up the new vehicle market. Does saying this in an annual statement become a kind of a bargaining chip in negotiations with bondholders and the union?
I think it does. I mean, it shows that the dire predictions made quite some time ago may be starting to come true. That says, you know, to bondholders or the unions, look, you know, you need to get on board with this or else we are going to end up in Chapter 11. I don't think that's the whole reason they've put this in their report, but I think it does help them to that degree.
But it does implicitly say, you know what, the stockholders, sorry, guys, but you're kind of out of the picture here. They're really not concerned about the stock price at this point.
And they can't be. I mean, it, you know, if that's your primary concern, the business goes under, the stockholders are going to lose anyway. So this is really an attempt to get the business solid and worry about the stock prices later.
Well, Jerome Vaughn, news program director for WDET in Detroit. A lot of folks are missing you around here. How's it getting back to work there in Detroit?
I like not getting up at 2:30 in the morning, so that's good.
Well, you got that going for you and your
word.
Wife. Your wife's speaking to you again, right?
Yes, mostly.
Mostly. All right, Jerome Vaughn, news program director for WDET in Detroit. A happy side of a sobering story out of GM this morning.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Imagining a world without Wall Street. Investors seem to be doing that on Wall Street this morning. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is down about 90 points. But a conversation about that in just a moment after headlines from Femi Okeh.
Thanks very much, John. The time is just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. NATO will be formally reaching out to Russia to restart diplomatic relations. The decision came today from a meeting of NATO foreign ministers in Brussels. The Secretary General for NATO, General Jaap de Hoop Scheffer, says that it's time to start formally talking to Russia.
I think we need to reflect on a positive agenda that befits the importance of NATO and Russia to European and indeed global security.
NATO froze its ties with Russia after the war with Georgia. Another topic on the NATO agenda is Afghanistan. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is proposing a high-level international conference on how to move forward in Afghanistan. She says that representatives from Afghanistan, Pakistan and other nations should all attend so that it could be sponsored by the United Nations. Two former top Bush aides, Karl Rove and Harriet Mears, have agreed to testify before Congress about the firings of nine U.S. attorneys. The agreement ends a lawsuit on whether former aides could be forced to testify about matters on which they advise the president, and that's the former president, George Bush. That's a look at some stories making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi. And here's a great idea for a movie.
The next battle is in the greatest jungle of them all, Wall Street.
We're going down a drain, okay? The stock is plummeting.
When it hits 18, buy it all.
Something big is going down. I want you to fill out the missing picture.
Hey, the jungle of Wall Street is looking a little pared down these days. Do you feel like you're cast in a bad Oliver Stone movie, thinking about the economy? Joining us today from Bainbridge Island, Washington, is David Corton. He's the author of Agenda for a New Economy, imagining that there is no Wall Street, from phantom wealth to real wealth. David, thanks so much for being here.
Delighted to be on your show.
You know, your book lays out a very interesting agenda, and it talks about something called phantom wealth being what Wall Street is all about, and that real wealth is actually a more grounded way of developing an economy. First of all, describe what you mean when you say phantom wealth.
Well, it's what Wall Street does. Basically, what it's in the business of is creating money out of nothing through pumping up financial bubbles and creating debt pyramids, creating all kinds of fictitious assets that are totally disconnected from the creation of anything of real value or utility. And, you know, in the United States, we've basically shifted our whole economy from producing things of real value to simply making money. And it's, you know, the whole thing is essentially a scam because it's creating financial claims for people who are producing absolutely nothing in return. And, you know, it's a system that by design was destined to ultimately collapse. That's finally happened, and we're paying the price. The unfortunate thing is that most of the efforts by the government to deal with the problem actually don't deal with the deeper issue that we're really dealing with a failed system design, and we need to make much deeper changes than anybody's talking about.
Well, it's one thing for someone like me to say, hey, you know, it's a bunch of paper that you're using and it's not real wealth. But you're a trained economist and a professor at the University of Washington.
I'm actually not a professor at University of Washington. I work independently, but I was on the Harvard Business School faculty.
Right, I'm misquoting myself here, but anyway, the point is made. You're trained as a critic of this sort of financial system. Why is it that the premise of the federal government seems to be we have to fix the financial system and everything else will get better?
Well, you know, we've gotten into kind of a cultural trance as a society. We've become conditioned to believe that that money is wealth and that making money is creating wealth, and it misses a very obvious point, which is that money is nothing but a number. It has no existence outside of the human mind, and we've gotten ourselves just totally misdirected in our thinking about economic activity. You know, it's most extraordinary that, you know, according to Kevin Phillips, it's actually been policy to shift ourselves away from producing anything of real value to simply creating money and assuming that our distinctive role in the global economy is to produce the money and to market and consume things that are produced by other people. It's ultimately an act of economic insanity. And it is hard to believe that intelligent people have gotten sucked into it, but that is exactly what's happened.
David, this is Farai. One of the things that strikes me is that I recently did a rollover of some retirement funds, and so I had money in stocks. I had to liquidate that, transfer it to, you know, rollover to another tax-free fund, and then reinvest it. Money was invented pretty much to create ways of transferring things. You know, if you were traveling, whatever. Are you arguing that money itself is flawed, that the whole idea of money is flawed, or just that the currency we have now and the investment systems we have now are not working? What kind of money would you like to see?
Well, yeah, money itself is not the problem. It's one of the most useful of human inventions in terms of facilitating exchange. The problem is that we've gotten into a situation where we've monetized more and more of our relationships, and gotten ourselves to a situation where we've got a society in which it's virtually impossible to survive without money. So we become focused on the money rather than on the things that we really need to live a productive life.
Well, let's focus on that focus then. If there were an economy that was grounded in this focus on real wealth, what would it look like? And is it scalable to a nation of 320 million or a planet of 6 billion?
Oh, absolutely. We would be focused on what are the things that we really need to produce a good life, rather than, you know, starting with a premise of what will it be most profitable to produce and sell. We would be much more conscious of the fact that we are, particularly in the United States, consuming way beyond our environmental means. And, you know, we've been headed not only for financial disaster, but also for environmental disaster. And the system, by the way, our money system is organized based on bank debt. We've created a system in which it's absolutely certain that that day by day we increase inequality.
Who enforces this? Is it a government? Is it individual consumers? How do you enforce these changes in decisions?
Well, first of all, we have to have a conversation and recognize that we are, that we've got an effective operating system in society. That we've got ourselves set up so that the decisions are all based on what will produce the greatest returns to money, which is a fiction in the first place, rather than what is required to improve the quality of our lives and make sure that that people have productive work, that they have food on the table, that they have adequate shelter, education, health care, and all the basics. That's what we need to start with. We should be, first of all, evaluating the performance of our economy based on the extent to which it is, in fact, providing those things. And look at what are our real resources, our skills, our technology, our land and natural resources, and how do we best organize to match our resources to our needs.
Which makes me wonder, getting to that agenda perhaps should not mean that we have to pass through some financial bailout for the banking system. We should go directly to the issue of what we need to live. Thank you for that. David Corton, the author of Agenda for a New Economy, From Phantom Wealth to Real Wealth. Thanks so much for joining us. And is this a housing crisis that we're dealing with or an identity crisis?
My name's Leah Clark, and I'm from Rochester, Michigan. And I just think that people are going to start to see through this American dream, that owning a house is great, but you're sacrificing your hobbies, seeing the world, maybe things that make you feel really alive that you can spend your money on for a house. A lot of my friends, I'm in my mid-20s, and a lot of my friends are spending all of their money on their house, and they feel trapped. And I think that the younger generation is going to start to see through this.
Wow, we want to hear specifically from homeowners like that. Are you discovering you can't afford your mortgage payments anymore? What do you need the government to do to help you? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Here's another takeaway.
They essentially established a blueprint for fighting the so-called war on drugs that was copied by every corner of the country and have essentially been the engine that have driven the prison expansion in this country over the last 30 years.
It's Jennifer Gonerman talking about the possible reform of New York State's Rockefeller drug laws after 35 years. If you missed anything on the program, including that conversation, take our podcast at thetakeaway.org.
I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.